doing so, asking questions, if you like, to Moses. Moses, what was it like to owe so much to so many? Remembering, of course, those who really took risks in order to preserve his life away at the beginning. Then we asked the question, Moses, what was it like to have the best of both worlds? And of course, maybe we would be tempted to think that being brought up in the palace of the daughter of Pharaoh was the best world. But he had those few short years at home. And it's evident that at that time, things were placed into his young life. Building blocks, memories, the word of God, things that would cause him to think about God's people later on. So the best of both worlds, a godly family. And then he went on to have the advantages of an education second to none at that time. So Moses, what was it like to have the best of both worlds? Moses, what was it like when you were faced with making choices? And we thought about that last week. We thought about a good choice he made. He chose to suffer hardship and affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of Egypt and the pleasures of the world. He made that choice, and as he does so, he steps out of the world he had been part of, a world of privilege, and he goes into the slums or ghettos of the Hebrews. But having made that good choice, he goes on to make a series of really poor choices. And one poor choice leads to making another and making another and making another. So that was what we thought about last time. Moses, what was it like when you were faced with making choices? And of course, we've made application in our own lives to these things. So in making bad choices, Moses had killed an Egyptian taskmaster. Albeit in response to that Egyptian's abuse of a Hebrew slave. And then having done that, they had to do something else. They had to hide the body, another bad choice. Moses had kind of compartmentalized his sin because he reckoned that what he had done was only wrong in the eyes of the Egyptians, not wrong in the eyes of the Hebrews. That was a mistake. Because they had witnessed it. He further reckoned that it wouldn't be considered a sin in the eyes of the Hebrews because it was done in their favor, in support of them. In fact, he was hoping that they might even see it as an act of heroism, that it would give him street cred. This guy who's just stepped out of a palace and here he is walking among. What a guy, what a man, look what he did. And we can assume that safely because he turns up the very next day right at the very same place. So obviously he had made all of these assumptions. In fact, we read that on the following day he appeared to them and the two he appeared to were fighting. And he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, "Why are you as brothers fighting against each other?" So this man of 40 years of age, you would expect to have been mature. He makes all of these choices. He decides to do these things. But it's not being done with the spiritual gift of wisdom. Remember that before he lifted up his hand to kill the Egyptian, there's a little detail put in there. He looked this way and that. And we reminded ourselves of the fact that he didn't look up. Wisdom teaches the believer to look up. And that's where we left it. And today we want to ask another question, but we'll come to that in a moment or two. D.L. Moody wrote this: Moses spent his first 40 years thinking he was somebody. He spent his next 40 years learning he was nobody. And he spent his third 40 years discovering what God could do with a nobody. I like that. So the question we want to ask ourselves today is this: Moses, what was it like to go from being a somebody to being a nobody? Because that's what happens. Let's read then in Exodus chapter 2 from verse 13. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and they said to him that did the wrong, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. In Acts, where Stephen is talking about these things under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, we read in chapter 7 from verse 26, on the following day he appeared to them as they were quarreling and tried to reconcile them by saying, men, you're brothers, why do you wrong each other? But the man who was wronging his brother thrust him aside, thrust Moses aside, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday? At this, Moses fled and became an exile in the land of Midian. Thrust aside, pushed away. Wow. Moses wasn't expecting that, was he? Remember how he supposed that his kinsmen would recognize him, would recognize him as their best hope, would recognize him as a chance for freedom. But they didn't really know him. So they were only able to make their judgment on what they had seen. And Moses' actions over those 2 days had sent out a very mixed message. I wonder, in our lives, are our actions sending out a mixed message? Because we are being read, as we discover in the New Testament, we are living books, letters, epistles, known and read of all. And as people look at our lives, are they getting a mixed message? Is it a contradictory message? Is it one that should say that I am a Bible believer, I am walking in the light, but yet there are things that I do and reactions that I have that aren't showing that? The problem with Moses is that he didn't realize that he was sending out a mixed message. Not in his wildest dreams did Moses think that his kinsmen would reject him. How different to Jesus. Jesus left glory and came into this world and came to his own, knowing that his own would not receive him. But Moses hadn't factored this into his plan. He just wasn't prepared for what that quarreling Hebrew was going to say to him. Because really what he was saying to Moses that day was, who do you think you are? But Moses was actually thinking more along the lines of, this is my own suggestion. He was thinking that when he stepped forward and interrupted these two guys, two brothers, two people who were related by blood as Hebrews, when they were fighting, they would say, oh, sorry, great Moses. Of course we shouldn't be fighting with each other. In fact, you've shown us that we're behaving no better than the taskmasters who are over us. Thank you, Moses, for your intervention. But that's not what Moses got, was it? Now, many's another person, if you were one of those Hebrew slaves, for example, a nobody, and Moses had challenged you, you would have been tempted, wouldn't you, to not go down that route of saying, who do you think you are? But if you want honesty, you'll get it from somebody who has nothing to lose. Isn't that right? And those two Egyptians, Hebrew slaves rather, they had nothing to lose. They were being worked to the death. Every day could have been their last. There were no health and safety requirements there. You don't work hard enough, just get beaten. He had nothing to lose. And that's why he comes and retorts to Moses with honesty. And Moses gets a wake-up call. You know, today we have many believers around us who want to be flattered, Now, I'm not talking here about genuine encouragement, because that's scriptural. Come alongside somebody and they need encouragement, or somebody has done something, and maybe it's something they've done for the first time in the work of the church, and you come along, oh, it's maybe been riddled with wee errors and mistakes, and you can't get the staff anyway nowadays. I mean, you only have to look at Mike. But whenever you come alongside them, you're realizing that this is their first time, and we all are the first time. I was thinking one day as I drove past the little hall in Martin's Bray in Coleraine, the first time I took a meeting. And I've often wondered, what on earth did I say? What did I preach in there? They did have me back right enough. But we've all had a first time, and we probably cringe when we think about that in a number of ways. But people came alongside, and they could have given us a list of criticisms, but they didn't. They encouraged us. But that's not what I mean here. I'm talking about flattery, deliberate flattery, in the full knowledge of the effect it will have on the person, especially if that person is a self-focused person and thrives on flattery. You know what we read in Proverbs 27:6? Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Wouldn't you rather have somebody who you know where you stand with them, and they know where they stand with you, and they will come faithfully? And we trust, as we've discovered in our series on the fruit of the Spirit, they will come in the Spirit and say, sister, brother, you know, maybe you need to think about this. Rather than patting you in the back and letting you go on and make bigger blunders down the road. There are many, many, many Christians in churches, and you get to know a feel for people, you know. And there are folk you just know, if you did take them aside and in grace and in love show them where they are and what could happen from what plan they're taking, they couldn't take it. You could even end up with split church. And that's sad. Elihu is one of my favourite characters in that huge long book of Job. You know the comforters that sit down with Job? I don't know why they get called comforters. There's not one shred of comfort in anything they have to say over chapters and chapters. And when one word will do, they need 100. But then Elihu, this younger man, you see, maturity doesn't come, as we've discovered in the life of Moses, by being 40 years of age. You can be very mature as a younger person. Timothy was. Paul says, don't let anybody look down on you because you're young, but you step up to the mark and show them by your example what you are and who you are and what you are in the Lord. But Elihu has listened to these boys, and he was very respectful. He sat back and he let them have their say. He honoured them as the older people. And then he steps up and he says in Job 32:21, I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery toward any person. And he was the one who had to say what Job needed to hear. And in a short space of time, we read these words, the Lord turned again the captivity of Job. Again, Proverbs 20:23, whoever rebukes a man will afterward find more favour than he who flatters with his tongue. That's how it should be. Moses didn't at that time need to be flattered. He needed to hear the truth. And Paul warns about preachers, especially in these days, when there is a departure, a falling away. He says, don't reduce yourself, preacher, to just tickling the ears. Preach the whole counsel of God. Well, what was the truth that Moses needed to hear at this point? Well, Moses was all over the place. And that's not leadership material, is it? He steps on the scene. He probably assumes, as we know he did assume, that the people would see him as their best hope of being delivered in some way or other, and we looked at some of that last week. But he, at that moment, wasn't leadership material. He hadn't wisdom. He thought the people would accept him if he just stepped forward and demonstrated his loyalty to his kinspeople, the Hebrews, in that very extreme action. But he was wrong. And across the space of 2 days, I want you to get this. Across the space of 2 days, he has become a nobody in the courts of Pharaoh and a nobody amongst the Hebrews. Isn't that interesting? From a somebody. Not just to a nobody in the eyes of Pharaoh because he turned his back and went to the Hebrews, but he's a nobody in both places. Can you try and enter into what he must be feeling? Where did it all go so wrong? Here's a man with an education second to none, and we've already looked at that. We'll not go over that again. But he had no wisdom. There are limits to education, but there's no limit to the fruit of the Spirit and the working of the Spirit. 1 Corinthians 1 and 25 says, the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. James 1 and 5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask God. He gives to all liberally, and it shall be given unto him. So he had an education. He also had a passion. He sees the plight of his kinsmen, and something stirs within him. Remember in our series, we had expectations on the fruit of the Spirit. We came to temperance, usually described as self-control, but I thought maybe to rule out a misunderstanding, we would say self-under control, because self-control could give the idea that I by myself can control myself and my actions. But you see, the fruit of the Spirit, there's not one part of that that we can do by ourselves. Remember, we emphasized that. This is hard. This is the work of the Spirit. That's why it's called the fruit of the Spirit. We need the Spirit to make the changes in our lives and make the difference that we have to be making. Otherwise, if we could do it ourselves, we wouldn't be calling it the fruit of the Spirit. Self under control. So he had a passion. He was passionate, but it wasn't under control. I believe this is one of the reasons that God didn't set Moses aside at that time. Didn't say, right, he's totally made a mess of this. I'll go to somebody else. Sure, he has a brother there called Aaron. God saw his passion, and passion can always be harnessed and steered in the right direction. Sadly, many of God's people and God's servants today don't make a great many blunders, really. They just fly under the radar through their life. They don't make then also a serious impact on the world around them. Why? Because they don't actually have the passion. So passion is good, but it needs to be also under the influence of the Spirit. But then there's something else. So we're asking ourselves here, where did it all go wrong? Because he'd had this education, he had passion. But he made a decision to step into a world inhabited by slaves who were his brethren. That's good. But it came in accordance with his timing. Remember we read, it came into his heart. And it's apparent, so apparent, that this was his timing and not God's. Wanting to make things happen. Isn't that a problem we all have? Wanting to make things happen. In Zechariah 4 and 6, we don't quote a great many verses from Zechariah, but here's a good one. Not by might, nor by power, but by my Spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. We forget that, don't we? You know I'm always chiming on, finish the verse. Saith the Lord of hosts. You know what that means? Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord who can do anything, who has every other power at his command. He can even make Pharaoh do things. And that's the one we need to look to. Here is Moses, the man who owed so much to so many, the man who had the best of both worlds, the man who made a good choice, but then unfortunately he starts to make a string of bad ones. And now he's friendless and afraid. I hope nobody feels like that today in here. Hope you don't. Would his grasp of science help him now? Would his grasp of the arts and literature help him now? Would they see him through? Would his knowledge of engineering and technology, that was the leading field at that time in the world, would that see him through? Would that help him work his way out of this mess? He goes from a somebody to a nobody. And worse still, he becomes a nobody on the run. So he's nobody in the courts of Pharaoh. He's nobody amongst the Hebrews. And he's going to go to a place called Midian. And guess what he's going to be there? A nobody. A fugitive. In Exodus 2, at the end of verse 14, those words, Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. And Pharaoh, when he heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. Stephen again in Acts 7 under inspiration says, then fled Moses at this saying and was a stranger in the land of Midian. So it was all right being a nobody in the palace because at least he knew the workings of the palace. He was a nobody amongst the Hebrews, but he had an understanding having been a child there of what went on there. But now he's completely out of that altogether and he's in Midian. We have young people here who will be moving to a different environment in September, October, some to college. And you'll maybe feel like that. You're going in, a stranger. And it might be in a strange land, depending where you go. But we trust that as a fellowship here, and certainly my heart as a pastor here, would be that you would go with something that Moses didn't have. With the Spirit of God and in such a way that he's controlling your life, young person. And also with God-given wisdom. What a difference that would make to go on into life and into your career. Or for anybody here who's making a step to do so with wisdom. None of us know when a change will come. Change of place, change of environment. Change of people, change of culture. And Moses fled. Now he's not the only person in the Bible to run away. I'm sure you can think of some. We read in 1 Kings 19 these words. Ahab, who's a king, a wicked king, spurred on by an even more wicked queen. Ahab told his wife Jezebel that what Elijah had done, that was the wonderful triumph on Mount Carmel in defeating the prophets of Baal. And she sent a message to Elijah, you killed my prophets, now I'm going to kill you. I pray that the God, speaking of her gods, will punish me even more severely if I don't do this by this time tomorrow. She's making a big bold statement there, isn't she? So Elijah hears this message and he's afraid, and this is what we read, he ran to the town of Beersheba. And then he walked a whole day into the desert and finally came to a large bush and sat down in its shade and said to the Lord, I've had enough. Who are we running from? What are we running from? Remember what we talked about when we asked the question discussing the actions of Moses and the hiding of the Egyptian taskmaster. What are we hiding? He ran as Moses ran. There's another one who ran, and there's no need to work out who this was through the verses, because there's a book named after him, and it's Jonah. The first verses in the book, a message from the Lord came to Jonah. The Lord said, go to Nineveh, preach against it. The sins of that people have come up to my attention. Do you know the sins of our nation are not overlooked by God? That's why we need to pray. But Jonah ran away from the Lord. And he went to Tarshish, got to Joppa, where he got on a ship, paid his fare, went on board. He was running away from the Lord. Twice that's emphasized. What are we running to? Because it's one thing running away from a person or a situation or a place. But what are we running to? Because it could just be the case of out of the frying pan into the fire. You think it's hot in the frying pan. Well, it's worse when you jump out into the flames. Do people ever stop and think about that? For Jonah, it was out of the will of God into the fish's belly. Where are we today? Are we in the fish's belly, spiritually speaking? Are we under a bush? Are we in the desert? Are we nowhere with God? Well, the wonderful thing is this. That might be how we feel, or it might be the mess we've got ourselves into. But I like the words of Psalm 139. Whither shall I go from thy presence? Or from thy spirit? Moses runs to Midian. Now, commentators have difficulty pinpointing where Midian was. And one of the best solutions to this I have heard in reading is that it's not so much a place called Midian, but a place inhabited by Midianites, because they appear to be nomadic people, vast number of them, and they covered a large area. The Midianites were descended from Abraham through Keturah, his second wife. And remember that Joseph was sold to Midianites, eventually making his way to Egypt. So why Midian? Moses, what took you there? If you're on the run, would you not have maybe thought, well, I'll go to Canaan that I've heard so much about. Now I'm willing to make a choice to be amongst the people of God. Well, I'll go maybe to Canaan and see what we've been missing for all these centuries. And it's only 230 miles away. And it's the place of my ancestry. It's the place of promise. But I'm told that, although that might make good sense, Canaan was under Egyptian control at that time. So, if you think about that, he's a fugitive, he's a criminal, but no matter what far-flung part of the world you go to, if it's still under British rule, you'll still be required to face British law, won't you? Moses was the same. So he goes 285 miles. From where he was in Egypt to the place where the Midianites were. Another reason for going was that they were nomadic, but there was a vast number of them. So they weren't settling down in structured walled cities and so on like that. There had been groups of them, possibly extended family groups, a wee bit like what it was for Abraham. It would be an ideal culture to blend into, wouldn't it? It'd be hard to trace. Imagine giving a resident address if you were a nomadic person, a nomad in Midian. They were those who were rich and in flocks and herds and camels. Again, great situation to disappear into, and a place that would always require labourers and work. It was a place of religion too, because we read of priests. And perhaps there was something passed down from the days of Abraham through those people that had been retained regarding the true God, the one God, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. And we can't be sure about that, because there's no definition that when we read of a priest, Reuel, better known, I would say, as Jethro, that when we read of him, that he was a priest of the Lord God. We don't know that for sure, but there's a couple of things would indicate to me that perhaps he was, because the name Reuel means friend of God or God is my shepherd. Now, those are both terms used, aren't they, in connection with Jehovah, the Lord God, Yahweh. Also, this priest, Reuel or Jethro, has two names. Remember how Jacob got a name change from Jacob to Israel? An encounter with God. Isn't it possible that this man had an encounter with God? Saul of Tarsus becomes Paul. He has an encounter with God. Simon becomes Peter. But one thing is clear. Jethro is a priest. And he might have loved to have a wee boy, but he had seven daughters. It reminds me of an old movie that was on the go when I was young. Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Exodus chapter 2 from verse 15. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water. And they filled the troughs of water, or to water their father's flock. Then shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that you're come home so soon?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and also drew water enough for us and watered the flocks." And he says to his daughters, "Where is he? Why is it that you've left him? Call him that he may eat bread or eat bread with us." He sits down at a well. Not the only place that has been an appointment with God, sure it's not. But there he is at a well, and he still looks like an Egyptian. Whether that's because of what he was wearing, or whether it's because he travelled at a right pace those 285 miles, to the extent that he hadn't time to regrow his hair and his beard in the Hebrew way. So he still looked like an Egyptian. So his running away has got him away from things. But he lands in Midian, he lands at a well, and straight away he's confronted with a conflict scenario. He had that the very first day he stepped out of the palace, the Egyptian and the Hebrew, the Egyptian he killed. The very next day, when he appears again, it's two Hebrews who are fighting, another conflict situation, and he makes a mess in both times, and it's the second one that results in him being on the run. And he's just stopped to draw breath and get a drink, and what happens? Another conflict situation. Does something keep happening to you? Have a good think. We have a God who wants us to be refined and to really shine. And sometimes when something comes along our way, it's God allowing that to happen to test us. And God has the right to test every genuine believer. Why? Well, if he's put his spirit within you, you have something the world hasn't got. And God has the right to test that. And it will be for your good, and it will be for the strengthening of your faith, and it will also be for the testimony around you. Never forget that. People are watching. People are thinking, well, if that happened to me, would the way he or she's doing that be the way I should do it? Remember that. And here he is, conflict, conflict, conflict. Abraham failed twice in the very same thing. He did it once and God said, "I'll give you another opportunity." What was that? He pretended Sarah was his sister and not his wife. That was deception. That was a failure. So here we find Moses. And he comes to the well. The seven daughters of Jethro are being pushed out of the way by the rest of the shepherds. Now that must have been something very familiar. A pattern must have emerged there, because Jethro is amazed when eventually the seven daughters come back, and they come back early. Why are you home so early? Sure, it normally takes you ages because those boys shove you to the back of the queue. Something had changed. Moses sees what's happening. He steps up and he delivers them. Now, if there were seven girls, I wouldn't like seven girls chasing after me. If I was in the supermarket and I was wanting to get to the queue, I wouldn't want to push seven women out of the way. Would you, men? So that makes me wonder at how many of the shepherds there were. And don't worry, sisters, I'm not that feared of women either. But it makes me wonder how many of the other shepherds there must have been to be able to do that, to be able to intimidate them in such a way that they would have to step aside and let them. So here's what I'm building. Moses chases, let's say, 14 men away. Or at least one for every woman. Even seven men. What a guy. And he chases them away. And he still has the energy. I love this. Must have had his shredded wheat. Because he still has the energy to water, give them water that they would need to bring home. And also water their flocks and herds. Moses could have said, "Oh, not again. More fighting. I'll just go to that well down the road." He could have, couldn't he? But he does something, and we never know by our actions what it will unlock or which door it will open, do we? He does something that opens a door for him to be able to have God work upon him for his second 40 years of his life. You know, many believers who are on the run from a situation, perhaps a conflict situation, and maybe that involves them moving to another place of worship, and I know what that's like. And then they say, "Well, I'm going to go there, but I'm not going to get involved because I've had not enough of it." And it's when you get involved that things start to happen. But here's Moses, and he has to make a decision. This has happened to me. This is why I'm here. This conflict kind of scenario. But what will I do? And he steps up and delivers seven sisters. Here's the thing I like about that. He was going to one day be a deliverer. And the first bunch of people he gets delivers seven sisters. D.L. Moody wanted to do so much for the Lord in a large, fashionable church. But they kept pushing him aside. They didn't really take him very seriously. But eventually he chimed on that much. Could I even teach Sunday school? And he says, "Oh, all our Sunday school classes are filled and we've a teacher for each one. We don't need you, you know." And he wasn't put off by that. He says, "Well, what if I bring a Sunday school class of my own? I would like faith like that here. It'd be great." Do you know what he did? He brought in about 40 young fellas, I think it was, just from the streets. And there was nothing they could say. Brought in a Sunday school class. He taught his own. He could have had his own Sunday school. And that was the beginning of D.L. Moody's marvelous career as a preacher of the gospel. There was a wee prayer meeting held in Kells in 1837. There was only four at it. Four. And then a couple of years later we came to know, and history records, the great 1859 revival. The church at Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost had only 120 in the upper room. That's maybe what's here today. And yet look at how the world was turned upside down. Despise not the day of small things. So Moses is left at the well. See, that's what happens when you look after the woman. They just abandon you. And he was left at the well. They went back to their father. And as we read together, he says, "Go and bring him to me." Moses, what was it like to go from being somebody to nobody? And let's think about that as we continue in the Lord's will in our series in the days to come. Our song at this time is "Like a River Glorious Is God's Perfect."